Hi, everyone, and welcome to Upzoned, a weekly podcast from Strongtowns Media that goes deep on just one big story from the week in urbanism, infrastructure, planning, policy, and beyond, literally anything related to the Strongtowns conversation. I'm Kia Wilson, and I'm here with our president and my pal, Chuck Marone.
Hey.
How are you doing, Chuck?
I'm doing great, Kia. It's gorgeous here in central Minnesota. We're having like a new summer or something. So yeah, it's beautiful. How are things there?
They're pretty good. We're getting like our kind of semi-annual week of fall weather in St. Louis before it will just like winter will fall down like a curtain, or we will have really solid summer weather until December. We'll find out. It's always kind of a grab bag this time of year. Well, this week, we are actually talking about an article that you recommended, Chuck, and it's from your home state's biggest newspaper, the Minneapolis Star Tribune. It's called Big Box Stores Fight for Lower Tax Bills. And as always, you can read it yourself by clicking the link in the podcast description. But Chuck, since this one was kind of your party today, why don't you kick us off? Why did you want to upzone this story for the week?
My gosh, this is such... I found this article to have so much like cognitive dissonance in it that just needed to be flushed out. So for example, in like the third paragraph of the story, you've got Christina Volkers, the city manager of Moorhead, which is a city, a fairly, you know, major city here in Minnesota up by Fargo. And this is her quote. She said, "We see them," meaning the big box stores, "as community partners. But one by one, they always seem to be challenging the property tax. So after Menards, we had Runnings, we had Target. I mean, it's just constant." And my jaw kind of dropped because I'm like, you see them as community partners. How naive are you? You know, like how I always like think of local economic development in this way as like the parade test. You know, does the business put a float in your 4th of July parade? And if they do, calling them a community partner is like not a bad, you know, you're probably not too far off. They're probably vested in the community. You know, they've got those kind of maybe we'll just call them social cultural ties to the people around them. If your company doesn't have a float in the 4th of July parade, they don't really care about you all that much, you know? And that's not to say that like the float in the 4th of July parade is like the only indicator, but it's like one of those general things where like, yeah, I'm pretty sure that Target is more worried about its shareholders, more worried about its stock price, more worried about, you know, its global partners than it is about you and your tax situation. The article just got better from there, but maybe I'll stop and let you kind of weigh in on that relationship, because these places are their businesses. And I personally don't fault them for that. But I think it's crazy to think that, you know, some corporation that has its headquarters somewhere else that you are willing to destroy like your whole city for is somehow your pal. Like I found that kind of crazy.
I totally agree. But I think this article was even a little more outrageous than big boxes are kind of day to day. The big news out of Minnesota is that the Targets and Walmarts of the world are sort of banding together to say, we are paying too much in property taxes. You are relying on us too much to sort of make your town work, which no one's kind of arguing that. But the Targets and Kmarts, et cetera, are all now saying, you have overvalued us. We've written a lot on Strong Towns about how big boxes, in a lot of ways, already aren't paying their fair share, at least when you look at it from how much property tax they are paying per acre of development. Why are they saying the opposite now in the retail world?
Well, let me put some nuance on that. Because you just said, we've said they're not paying their share. And I wouldn't say it that way.
Yeah.
I would say they're not very productive land use. In other words, they're not really, you know, a very good use of land. I like how Joe Minicozzi explains it. He's got a great slide in his presentation where he's like, you got a farm field. What would you rather grow? You know, would you rather grow soybeans or corn or cannabis? And then he puts up like the value per, you know, the return per bushel on each one. And you see that, you know, soybeans are pretty low value crop. Corn's a pretty low value crop. Cannabis is a pretty high value crop in terms of like the returns you get. And so he's like, you know, you have a choice. Which one would you grow? Well, cities, when they put in big box stores from a property tax standpoint in particular, are growing like the lowest value crop. They're growing the least productive use of land. You get the least amount of value per acre of land that you chew up. And, you know, our analysis has kind of added to Joe's and said, you know what, for every acre of land you chew up, there's a corresponding cost with that for all the sewer and water, for the roads and sidewalks, for, you know, your transportation system, for congestion and all, you know, policing and all this stuff. So these are the highest cost, lowest productive approaches. So when you say they're not paying their share, that's a little bit like saying, you know, when you grow the field of soybeans, it's not paying as much as the field of cannabis. Yeah, it's not. It's a totally different crop. Conversely, what the big box stores are saying, and here's like the controversial thing, I actually think they're right. Like, I actually think they're right by the law. What they're saying is that, and let me paraphrase it this way, because they don't say it this way, but I'll say it in like, you know, real world terms. Here's what they're saying. Our stores are junk. They're not really built like really nice places. They're just like concrete boxes with a junky roof put on it. They're basically like glorified pole barns. You're charging us as if we're building really nice buildings, and we're not. We're building junky buildings. And the thing is, they have no reuse. So once we leave them, they can't be used for anything else that's very productive. So for you to come in as a city and say, these buildings have enormous value, they're really, really expensive, we're going to tax you really high, is not right. It's not right on any factor that we can go out and measure. The amount of materials we have into it, the longevity of it, the resale value of it, none of that is applied to what we're doing. You're taxing us wrong. And here's the sad thing. The big box stores are right. They're actually right on that.
Yeah. I think that's true, but I would also add to it that the reason that this is such a problem that big box stores now want to get kind of out of their tax obligations, which I totally agree, Chuck, like they shouldn't be paying as much as they are in the sense that they are not as valuable as they're currently being valued, is that they, you talked about all of the costs associated with building a big box store. There's also opportunity cost. You're losing out on all of that rich development. And in many cases, it's directly contributing to the closure of small and medium-sized businesses that would have been much, much, much more productive. They are creating the system in some ways of their own devaluation, but you know, it kind of doesn't matter who you point fingers at a certain point, because it is what it is. You have a junky building in the middle of town and you can't do anything with it.
Right. I feel like that quote from the Moorhead person was kind of indicative of this feeling that we're getting suckered, right? The big box stores come to town. I remember when this happened here in the early 90s. I went away to basic training in the Army, my summer between my junior and senior year of high school. And when I came back, we had Walmart and Target. They just were there. Like, they weren't there when I left and they were there when I got back. And within a couple of years, our downtown was gutted. Whatever was left of local retail went away. And we accepted that. Like, we made that bargain. We made that deal here and we did it. And I was certainly, you know, after a few years as an engineer, part of that process. I mean, I helped Home Depot come in. I helped Menards come in, which we should talk about the Menards one, cause that's insane. Mm-hmm. But I worked on these and I was part of this small town kind of consensus that, boy, now we get access to the kind of stuff they get in a big city and we don't have to drive a long distance to buy shoes. And, I can get parts for my computer, I remember thinking, instead of having to drive to St. Cloud, which is the next biggest city an hour away. And we took that bargain, right? Because it meant low prices for us and bigger selection for us. And yeah, it cost us our downtown and local retailers, but those guys were ripping us off anyway. I mean, they were charging way too much for shoes and what have you. So, you know, it's the market. And what we find out, in this kind of sucker punch kind of way, is that we were, in a sense, sold a bill of goods, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we may get low prices, but now we have like not as many jobs. We may have low prices and more selection, But now like our community's broke and we have to, you know, come up with ways to pay for this. And now to kind of, you know, sucker punch us all off, they're coming back saying, you know, we're paying way too much taxes now. You guys got to lower that. And they're right. And that's the whole, I think the reaction is like, we were fooled and it's hard to come to grips with, right? I think that's just a human reaction. Like, I don't want to believe it. I want to believe they're community partners. And I sit back and look at that and go, wow, we're crazy, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this gets to the core of a question we get a lot at Strongtowns, which is, okay, you guys are saying that the taxation value per acre is all off. You're picking all the wrong uses. Why can't we just change the way we tax instead of changing the way we build? It's kind of a classic super liberal economic argument is let's just make sure that everyone's paying a lot more. What's the problem with that kind of solution?
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I do think it's really interesting because you said it's a classic liberal solution. Just last week, and I saw this because I tend to be a little more right of center. And sometimes my news feed includes, although I do have a pretty liberal news feed, I saw this piece from Tucker Carlson last week, and it basically was, I'll summarize Tucker Carlson. I think he's on Fox News. He said, why is Bernie Sanders the only one talking about this? Why is the federal government subsidizing Amazon and Walmart and, you know, all these places by basically paying all their employees benefits? You know, I have a job. My employer pays my benefits. Other people have jobs. Their employers pay their benefits. Why is the basic healthcare and benefits of these, you know, these major U.S. retailers, why are they being paid by the federal government? And so I think that there is an interesting, you know, kind of emerging, maybe we call it fringe bipartisan consensus, mm-hmm. that, you know, something is messed up here with the economics of these places. So if you're a city, I mean, you don't have the kind of sad thing right now about municipal governments is that you don't have a choice about how you tax. The state governments have all gone now and said, we're going to take away essentially all the tools that state governments or local governments have to decide how they're going to tax, where they're going to tax, what they're going to tax. So you basically have, you know, your hands tied, like this is what we have to do. But let's say we had a consensus to change that and redo that. If we went in and charged essentially the cost of what it would take to service and maintain that property, you just wouldn't, you wouldn't get a Target there. You wouldn't get a Walmart or a Menards there. You those places wouldn't come there because it's not a viable business model if they're not having their costs subsidized by the community. Not only that, you know, just long term, the amount of, I mean, when I say like I helped Home Depot, I helped Home Depot like work through the city process, which included the public investing, you know, millions of dollars in infrastructure and then taking over the long-term liability and promise of millions of dollars of infrastructure so that we could get a Home Depot. And we did this with Super Walmart and Target, you know, and everything else. Those investments now are like eternal investments for the community. You know, we have promised we will forever, you know, world without end, we will maintain this road and we will maintain this pipe. And in fact, we're so confident about that, we actually have extended the pipe now further and connected more people up. When that big box store goes, you know, out of business or closes up and moves to the next town, or when they, you know, argue that they're paying too much taxes, or even if, you know, we charge them what was fair and then they just decided, screw it, we're going to move to some other place. You're left with this site with nothing, and you still have the millions of dollars of eternal promises that you've made. That's what, you know, I don't think we solve this through tax policy, not at this point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that I feel like you've really taught me since I've been here. And I want to add one more thing. It's just that systems of taxation are systems. You don't get to juice them when you find yourself with a debt. You don't get to say, okay, the big box store moved out. How about we just raise the taxes on all of our residents this year? There would be riots, and there should be. So the argument that what we need to do is just like finagle things on the tax side economically, you know, like pull some puppet strings to make it all work, print some more money, that argument can sound really seductive because money is fake. Sure. But by the same token, systems are real, and the consistency of systems within our political system has real implications for families. And I don't know, I just wanted to kind of get into the theoretical of it a little bit, because it is a common question, and I see why it's a question. But when you think about it through to the next step, it's like, oh yeah, no, that wouldn't work at all.
I think we're, could I just add like one thing to that? Because I do think we're seduced, you know, both on the left and on the right with macroeconomic arguments. And, you know, we could debate them all day long. And I do have people all the time who get on my case about this. At the very local level, if you're not building enough private wealth that you can tax to take care of the kind of communal public obligations and promises that you've made, it doesn't work. And we have a macro economy that is not based on wealth creation, you know, broad wealth creation. You know, we've ended up with a system that has wealth concentration, but not broad wealth creation. We have a macro economy based on kind of the velocity of money. How many transactions can we get going? How much GDP can we have? At the local level, that just doesn't work. You could have all the transactions in the world, but if you're not building any wealth, there's nothing there to tax. You know, even if you have a sales tax, you can only squeeze so much, you know, out of a system where there's no wealth. You know, go to a very poor city and look, and they still have to buy food, and they still have to buy toilet paper and toothpaste, and they still have to buy gasoline. And, you know, there's transactions there, but you can't get enough money out of it because there's no wealth. If we don't broadly build wealth in our communities, in our neighborhoods, on our blocks, it doesn't matter what kind of tax system you want to overlay on that. It's just not going to work.
Absolutely. So to bring us back down to earth a little bit, I want to talk about the scale of this problem. The Tribune gives the example of a small city called Dilworth, Minnesota. I'm wondering if you've Dilworth. Ever been there.
I have, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it says that in Dilworth, their Walmart accounts for a full 5% of their annual tax revenue, which is staggering to me. Is that a pretty typical number in small communities across Minnesota and across the rest of the U.S.?
Yeah, it is actually. And places with sales tax, it's even more. This is the, you know, I've said this many times, and I think people think it's hyperbole. If you listen to the Strong Towns podcast and you caught my interview a couple of weeks ago with, I can't remember her name now, I'm so embarrassed, where we talked about rural Kansas. The crisis of small town America is acute, and it falls along these strong towns lines, because if you're a suburb or you're a, you know, major metropolitan area, and you've made these mistakes with the big box stores and stuff, you actually have enough, and I'm just going to call it slack in your system, to kind of overcome those mistakes and you know, figure things out. You've got enough fallback room, enough productive places to do it. If you're a small town, you've basically wiped out your city in this bargain, and now you've been suckered. And when it goes away, it's over. I mean, that's it. These are really, really fragile places. We have 854 cities in Minnesota, and I was kind of lambasted a few years ago for saying, I think in 2 decades, we have fewer than 400. I don't see how half of them survive at all. And a large part of it is this kind of trade-off. And of course, you know, in rural areas in particular, if you're the one that gets the Walmart, that means that you can survive 20 years longer than the one that doesn't. The one that doesn't loses everything because everyone from their town just drives to yours now. So there is kind of like a hanging on strategy that the big box stores provide, but this is devastating for rural America. And as these stores go in and revalue themselves, and as they go in and kind of downshift and go away, you see the dollar stores come in, you know, like the next line of predators feeding on like the dying carcass. And then, you know, what comes next? Nothing. You can go to Western Minnesota and see this happening now. You can go to the Dakotas and see this happening now. And so, you know, we talked about Kansas and a couple of weeks on the podcast and heard about the kind of this fragileness. We're in the end game for a lot of these places. And I think it's a huge tragedy. And I think we're struggling to explain why it happens when, to me, it's like very simple. We just destroyed the wealth in these places, and there's nothing left to sustain them.
Well, that's a bummer, totally. But there is an upside that we always need to talk about, which is that there is another way to build, and that's building strong towns, getting you, your neighbors, your leaders, others plugged into our conversation and talking about new ways to do it. And best of all, you can do it kind of step by step, small incremental movements over time can do so much. So what do you think the way out is for rural America? I'm curious if you have any sort of sunny thoughts.
Boy, now you're really going to get into like the depressing. Well, it's interesting because I wrote this piece years ago about hospice care for small towns. My board at the time, which was much more kind of like trying to micromanage the content stream, they flipped out on me. They're like, "We can't say that. We can't talk about that." And you know, to me, it was in a sense like self-evident. I think that there's a big shakeout coming, and who knows how it ends. If you're a major metropolitan area, I think the decisions you have to make today is how hard is this transition going to be, and how quickly do we get through it in with the least amount of harm to people. If you're a small town, I think the questions you have are more about survival. Like, is this place going to be here 20 years from now? And that means that you've got to like very quickly jettison a lot of dead ideas and transition to something that would be a lot more resilient, a lot more, you know, adaptable and productive than what you're doing today. And culturally, that's really, really hard, especially when, you know, I used to do engineering for all these small towns and do plannings for tunnel moment. And you'd go in the meeting and the youngest person on the board would be 65 and the median age in the city would be 55. And you just realize like, there's no one here with the energy, to kind of see things differently and make it change. So you ask like, what would you do? I think that the smaller you are, the more urgent the case becomes, for making incremental investments, trying to get, you know, local, anything local back. I mean, whether it's cutting hair or, you know, that's always the example that I use at places like, where do you guys get your hair cut? Well, we all drive 45 miles to the next city. Why? Like, there's nobody here that can cut hair. Well, not at the scale that they would need to open a you know, beautician place. And I'm like, well, what if you just did it one day a week? You know, like, can you get that started? Like, what can we do? I think you've got to be asking, if you're very small, some of those desperate questions about how do we, back to Jane Jacobs 101, how do we replace imports? How do we keep our capital here and stop it from just getting sucked out of the community in kind of an extractive way?
Yeah, and I would add to that, the farmers market in rural America is one of the most amazing things that I get to experience when I go home and visit my dad, who lives in sort of borderline between rural and suburban Cleveland. It's a little town called Bainbridge. Those are gathering places that are cheap to put up, that you can set up a stall and you can try something and see how it goes. You know, you say these are desperate little moves, Chuck, but I would say they're feasible moves and you need them and you should have some urgency about it, but it's also something that you can do and you can take a lot of pride in, which I think is pretty exciting.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And you know, I think we're talking a little bit about scale here. I look at a place like Muskegon where I was, you know, a couple of weeks ago, our 2018 strongest town winner. You've got a population there of about 40,000, and their farmer's market is amazing. It's just fantastic. And some of the things they've done with pop-up shops and little kind of micro investments to kind of build off of that has been just phenomenal. I think this is a place that will endure, that will be there, that is going to prosper. They're definitely on the right track. Little town of Longville, Minnesota. And let me look this up a little bit, because I can't remember the population, but I used to be the city engineer of Longville, for if you believe that. 152 people. Wow. This place has their school's closed, their businesses have closed, everything's gone. They used to have hundreds of people. They used to have, you could get dry cleaning in town. They had a florist, they had many restaurants, they had grocery, they had all this stuff. Nothing. It's just gone. Little town of Emily, Minnesota. I was the city planner there for a decade. My company that I ran, population 830. Same kind of thing. I was talking to people who were, in their 60s, and they said, back when we were kids, you had, two competing hardware stores, and we had, they went through like the litany of things. I looked, the population back then was like 700. So actually smaller than what it is today. And they had this whole like local economic ecosystem. All the people in Emily today drive to Brainerd, to my town, to go to the big box stores. That's where they do all their shopping. They once every couple of weeks, they drive to the big box store. They buy all their groceries. They come back home. That city has essentially like no real future unless they do something really radical. And those are very, very small towns. And we say, 830 people. Yeah. The federal government over the last, 2 decades has probably dropped $10 million into that place, building sewer systems and water systems and stuff. There's, real people that live there whose kind of livelihoods are being destroyed and lives are being destroyed. And so that's a scale of like small and marginal that we often discount. But I'll tie this back to like our larger cultural conversation. When you look at that red and blue map, those are the red places. Those are the deep red places. And things are happening there that don't really, are not really satisfactorily explained by the national narrative. And, these people are desperate and they're poor and they don't have a lot of optimism about things, and it's hard to blame them. Right. So I think you have to separate the Muskegons, those kind of what I would call like a small, mid-sized city in 40,000 range. I know a lot of our listeners probably think of a small city as being like a couple hundred thousand or whatever. They come a lot smaller than that. And those are the places that we've just completely, I think, wiped out and we'll be saying goodbye to over the next couple of decades. And that's going to be a lot of kind of social upheaval.
Jeez. Okay. So well, trying to end on a positive note, but how about this? Let's move into the down zone. Let's talk about what we've been reading, listening to, watching for the week. Make it sunny if you could, Chuck. What have you been into lately?
You want me to say something happy now? guess what book I listened to on audio tape? I was in Kansas City the last 2 days, and so I had a long, drive to the airport, a flight, and then the reverse on the way back. And I got through the entire Bob Woodward book, Fear. Yep. So I really don't have a lot of happy things going through my head right now.
Sure.
But it was a good book. And I will say this for all the people, and people will get mad at me for saying this, but my impressions of like the level of craziness, it was actually the book described a situation that was crazy, but less crazy than my brain had made it. So maybe that's like one bit of optimism.
So the Bob Woodward book, he's a journalist who investigated the Trump White House. Do I have that right?
Well, Bob Woodward, and I don't mean to be like the old guy here on the podcast, but Bob Woodward is like one of the journalists who uncovered Watergate and basically took down Richard Nixon. And he is a very well-respected journalist reporter who has written books. The ones that I've read, he wrote a couple books on the Bush White House, a couple books on the Obama White House, and now has written a similar book on the Trump White House. And he gets really good access to people. He kind of writes about the behind the scenes blow to, you know, day-to-day, blow-by-blow kind of what has gone on. And it's a great insight. And I found all of them, the Bush and the Obama, and now this one on the Trump White House, very illuminating. So I think he's a great writer and he's a great journalist. So you should definitely read it.
I will. Well, I'm working right now on a book called Payback that's actually by Margaret Atwood, who you might know, Chuck, and listeners might know as the woman who wrote The Handmaid's Tale. She's best known as like a near science fiction author, but she wrote a book of nonfiction 10 years ago about debt, and it's fascinating. It's about sort of our cultural associations, our religious associations, how debt works in literature, and it's wonderful. I think you would really like it. And, you know, also not a super sunny one, but something that's just like darkly funny, really interesting, and something that I think Strongtown's advocates should read if you want to talk about the emotional and psychological reasons behind how we view spending in our culture and how we pin it to notions of morality in a really cool, interesting way.
What is this one, the Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth, that one?
That one, yep.
Here's the interesting thing about that. I'm not familiar with this book, but I'm looking at it right now. It was published in 2008.
Oh yeah.
Which is like the, you know, that was like peak debt. You know, let's call it, you know, the prior peak debt. We're actually above that now in many, many metrics. I'm interested in what you'll have to report back. I'm interested in like how prescient her take was on, because she obviously wrote this before the whole kind of debt unwinding after 2008. And I wonder what she had to say about it.
Yeah. You know, she's mostly focused on like ancient ideas of debt, but she does talk a little bit about how in Canada, which is where Margaret Atwood is from, the housing crisis was already well underway. It was in the US as well. And that how that plays into our historical relationship to debt as it's changed over the centuries is fascinating. Yeah. It's a really, really good read. So
let me know. I'll put it on my list.
Yeah, will do. Well, thank you so much for listening to UpZone. This has been a Strongtowns podcast. If you'd like to support Strongtowns, you can do so by going to strongtowns.org/membership to join the movement. Any contribution helps us do this podcast and everything else we do. And if you haven't already and you care about North Texas communities, be sure to check out strongtowns.org/Texas-gathering. We're doing a really cool event down in Plano that I could not be more excited for. It starts on October 3rd. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week.